vast, trackless desert. Roadless, almost unknown, unmapped. In September 1933, two American geologists waded ashore on the nearby coast to begin a search in this strange, barren land.
Welcome to the Unseen Book Club, a podcast about politics and radical narrative. I'm Dan.
And I'm Max.
And this week, we are talking about Abdulrahman Munif's Cities of Salt. Max, tell us about Cities of Salt.
So Cities of Salt is actually, we're reading the first book in Cities of Salt, which is a pentology, originally written five books. The first one is in English, published as Cities of Salt, and Arabic, I think it was published as The Oasis, maybe, would be the literal translation. And these five books kind of cover the different incidents in the creation of the Saudi state and also the beginning of oil exploitation in the Persian Gulf and specifically Saudi Arabia, starting around the 1930s. So this book is more focused specifically on a Bedouin community in the deserts of what is now Saudi Arabia. What was then Saudi Arabia, but less markedly part of a country, it feels like. And tracks kind of the lives of many people as United States oil prospectors come in to this oasis town in the middle of the desert, kind of a caravan trading town, prospect for oil, find it. And then the scene shifts to a coastal town, Haran, which is a fictionalized town, but based on some of the first towns in Saudi Arabia that where oil was exported and found, and to the building of the pipeline and kind of the development of the petro economy in Saudi Arabia. There's a lot more to it, and it's a lot less top view than what I just said. It's really about the experiences of the people in these Bedouin communities as they go from living the life that they've lived in the desert, that's based around caravans, that's based around the growing of some crops, the raising of animals in the desert, to becoming really conscripted as workers and made to be the kind of the new oil proletariat in this town, and then their reactions to it. It's an incredible book. This synopsis does not do it justice at all.
Why we have a whole discussion.
Yeah. But I think those are the kind of the broad strokes. So Dan, why don't you tell me, you were the one who suggested this book, and I had never heard of Abdulrahman Munif before. And so this has been an amazing discovery just to kind of come across this. How did you find this book?
So shout out to two people. Charmaine Chua, thank you for posting about it on Facebook. Your very brief plot synopsis emphasized petroeconomy, social history, labor struggle, and I said, oh, we should read this for The Unseen. The second person I want to shout out is Watts. I put out a call asking if anybody had any background reading or context readings for this book, because for me, this is just a huge gap in my knowledge of world history and 20th century politics is the Middle East.
And also, I think specifically, if I can cut in, like, not just the Middle East, but this particular, like, this, the Arab Peninsula and the interior deserts of the Arab Peninsula, which is really just, you know, obviously the Middle East is a diverse place with, like, so many different histories. And this is about, you know, people living in the desert where there's not as much information. It's a lot different than the lives of people in Beirut. And this is actually something that comes out in the book is like, you know, a lot of like there'd be doctors that show up or people with more education or something. And invariably they're from, it's, you get the sense that even in the Arab context, this is an area that's outside of the metropole, that's outside of the center. It's kind of, especially at this time, before oil wealth is a kind of periphery, because the centers culturally, especially in the cities, are Cairo, Beirut, and then obviously some of the other big cities, Baghdad. And this place, this description of this place, feels very far away from that.
Yeah, so well said. I wanted to shout out Watts, because Watts was able to provide a context for me with some literature from a class they took 10 years ago. They emailed us a bunch of readings that helped put this book in context for me. But more directly, I did had the opportunity to read more about Abdulrahman Munif in a couple different forums. One that was really insightful was kind of a short biography. It appeared in the New Left Review after Munif's death in 2004 by Sabri Hafez. I believe that they were correspondents and friends. Briefly, Munif was born in Amman, Jordan, in 1933 to a Saudi caravan trader and an Iraqi mother. And so his father had homes in Syria, in Jordan, and in Arabia. Munif went to study law in Baghdad in the 1950s. And this is a time of teeming political activity in the Middle East more broadly. And he became an early Ba'ath Party member. Ba'ath Party was a manifestation of pan-Arabic politics.
Which I think is worth getting a little into, because it feels like Munif really, that political moment, which I think is not, we see the reflections of, but it's not around as much in the same way. Yeah, it was a kind of a post-colonial or anti-colonial politics that was pan-Arabic, based on the idea of, if not like just like a politically united or like confederated Arabian states or something. And with, as I understand it, a social democratic flavor. I mean, there was like also a lot of communist organizing at the time. There were a lot, and we're talking in Syria and Iraq, where are, of course, the countries where the Ba'ath Party ended up in power under Saddam Hussein and the Assad family. But prior to those takeovers, it was kind of, it was almost connected to like the third world or non-aligned movement, where there was a sense of socialism, but maybe not communism as such, and an orientation towards post-colonialism. And I think seems like in Munif's case, a really strong orientation towards this question of oil and being able to use that for the development, the more positive development of the countries where oil is found.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading about the coups that led to the rise of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, and communists were at one point aligned, and at one point after the Ba'ath Party took over, disciplined and purged.
As well as apparently like left Ba'ath elements, right? It's like, yeah, the Ba'ath Party obviously just became the party of power in Syria and Iraq, but like, and like not in a united way, obviously, but like Munif also kind of seemed to represent a specific kind of left wing of the Ba'ath Party that was also persecuted.
Yeah, and that's part of what attracted me to his biography. He becomes an early party member in Baghdad, and his Saudi nationality made him kind of a prized figure in this political movement. So he was banished from Baghdad for his political activities after a protest wave. He finished his degree in Cairo and won a Ba'ath Party scholarship to study in Yugoslavia, where he got a doctorate in oil economics in the early 60s. The background is that the party was preparing cadre who could run national oil industries once they took power, which they did. When the Ba'ath Party took power in Iraq and Syria around the same time, the Saudi government stripped Munif and presumably other Saudis of their nationalities.
I thought that happened when he wrote this book.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the impression that I got from some of the other bios, but this was not a cultural, but a political move.
Mm-hmm.
So he was stripped of his Saudi nationality and went to Syria. And again, this is the early 60s. So he worked in the oil ministry from 1965 to 1973. And he published his first novel in 1972. And back to what you were saying about where he kind of represented a left wing of the party, Hafez describes that he would always been a kind of discordant voice in the party. And I'm assuming that this is maybe on humanistic grounds. Like he was stoked about
purges
and massacres and all that crap. So,
well, his first novel was about, seems to be about imprisonment and political prisoners.
So even though he worked for the Syrian state, he actually had retired from the party in 1965. So he ended his formal role as party cadre maybe a decade after he joined. And there's a quote from Hafez: "Knowing Munif well as I did, it is hard to imagine this insightful intellectual and avid reader of literature as an insider to a Ba'athist regime in power. He appeared rather an eternal exile whose independent mind, deep-rooted values, self-doubt, and constant questioning would be anathema to party discipline. His reserved demeanor and fastidious manners in society were often mistaken for coldness and emotional incapacity. In fact, they were the products of years of clandestine political activity and a necessary defensive mechanism to protect himself and guard his life. If anything was deeply ingrained in him, it was an acute sense that he had started his literary career too late and had wasted valuable years, making him determined to safeguard the primacy of his writing." And so that quote from Munif about his politics and writing: "Party and political work was my window of communication to others, as it was a way of changing the world through ordering intellectual political relationships. When I was in the party, I wasn't one of the highly disciplined people. I was accused of corrupting the youth of the party through luring them into reading the theater and the novel and into conducting literary and intellectual discussions. In my opinion, literary text is part of the political culture, and when I hit a barrier that I couldn't overcome, I had to find another way of communicating with others."
There you have it, folks. We're luring the youth with literature.
As you were saying earlier, this book is about a geopolitical periphery.
Mm-hmm.
Munif's life was deeply cosmopolitan. That he wrote this book in France, and he studied in Yugoslavia, and he never lived in the Arabian Peninsula, and he spent his life kind of in this pan-Arabic movement. I think that there's this tension between context and the book itself.
And it's interesting because it seems like he's someone who has his foot in kind of like halfway in, halfway out of a lot of things. Because he's, again, it's like his mother was Iraqi, his father was from Saudi Arabia, and it sounds like he had the experience of going and spending summers in his father's village and things like that.
Yeah.
And then this tension of being later, the tension of being kind of like a underground party militant, and then basically kind of like an oil technocrat, and then a writer, right? It's like and then also someone who eventually has this experience of going from the cities of the Middle East to France, to Europe, right? So it seems like this, and that you feel that there's an interesting, I don't know if you have this sense, I felt through a lot of this book that there's kind of an interesting kind of like wry distance to this book, in the way that he describes his characters or the narrative orientation to it. It's not even ironic or critical or mocking, but there's a certain kind of, I don't know, I do get that sense of him as a writer of being someone who's able to step back and is I think also making very intentional choices as a writer. I mean, a very precise writer in some ways in terms of how narrative and metaphor progress in this book.
So, Max, can you say more about how the narrative works in this book?
So, okay. Yeah. And I think that for me, it's really interesting because I actually think this book really gets at the heart of one thing that we've been circling around a lot with this project, right? Which is that we understand who we are through the stories we tell, right? We understand like what we can do in the world and actually like literally what we are as a self. And I think that one of the kind of like things that I think about a lot is the way that, for lack of a better word, kind of the bourgeois novel or maybe the like humanist novel creates us as individuals. It puts forth an idea of what it means to be in the world, that we are individuals with a specific psychological development, that we're affected by our environment, and then we like grow in certain ways. But we're basically the thing that we should pay attention to in this, you know, in a many kind of like Western novels, especially of the 20th century, is the individual. Book should be about a protagonist and their inner life. And especially at the beginning, this book is not quite like that. There's characters and there's strong characters and you have a real sense of them, right? And you have a sense of their interiority and how they're feeling. But it's not the point. Especially in the beginning, this is a book about this community and their rhythms of life, the way that people relate to these caravans who come through periodically, the poverty of the community. There's an interesting section early in the book where it's like, you know, you hear this kind of like, we were poor but happy thing so much. And there's a line about that. But then it kind of goes on to be like, yeah, you know, the children are like, they're, you know, it just starts to describe the children suffering from malnourishment. Poor but happy really means like poor, poor. This is a group of people who like do not have a lot. So it's about that rhythm of life. Then for me, it's interesting that the way that that kind of communal sense of narrative turns into stories about individuals, but how people are turned into individuals in order to work. So at the same time that we see people kind of like being in the story, being broken off from their communities, family scatters, their homes literally bulldozed to make space for either kind of like the colonial encampment of the people from the US or for like literal oil wells and stuff. At the same time we see that, we start to see like an individualization of narrative and metaphor, where it's only later in the book, there's this really interesting moment where it talks about people traveling from different towns in the desert in the entire book. And in the beginning, it talks about how long it takes them to get there or what the journey was like.
The ancient oasis of Hofuf in Saudi Arabia's eastern region. For thousands of years, the meeting place for trading caravans.
And it's only about 2/3 in the book that it's like, oh, this town to this town was about 150 miles or whatever. And it's like this amazing thing where it's like this, the way that the characters understand the world and the relation to them starts to be marked by like measurement, by individuality, rather than a sense of like rhythm and immersion in tribe and community.
Yeah, I do see the primary narrative as a transition to modernity, to a world dying and a new one emerging, kind of right underneath people's feet. And it a lot of these things occur on the level of the cultural id, the collective understanding. The book opens with, as you said, these descriptions of the rhythms of life, and they are kind of very idyllic, pastoral, even if it's it's very clearly not romanticizing anything, but it opens. Wadi al-Un, an outpouring of green amid the harsh, obdurate desert, as if it had burst from within the earth or fallen from the sky. It was nothing like its surroundings, or rather had no connection with them, dazzling you with curiosity and wonder. How had water and greenery burst out of in a place like this? But the wonder vanished gradually, giving way to a mysterious respect and contemplation. It was one of those rare cases of nature expressing its genius and willfulness in defiance of any explanation. So this is the view from the people who live there, and it does have a sense of, you know, since time immemorial. The primary social kind of economic rhythm is the rhythm of the caravans. And early in the book, caravans and travel feature heavily. For caravans, Wadi al-Un was a phenomenon, something of a miracle, unbelievable to those who saw it for the first time and unforgettable forever after. The Wadi's name was repeated at all stages of a journey, in setting out and returning. How much longer to Wadi al-Un? If we make it to Wadi al-Un, we'll rest up for a few days before going on. And where are you, Wadi al-Un, earthly paradise? Caravans are also expressed in the psychology of people at so many points in the book. Munif imbues this desire in almost all the men that we encounter, this desire to travel, this focus on travel that shows up in characters at different stages of life, kind of links this like cultural register to that cosmopolitanism of the Middle East. Like, even if this is a periphery, it is and has always been intimately connected to the wider world that it exists in.
So, and borderlessness, right? Like, it's amazing because it's like, again, like, especially early in the book, nobody's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to Lebanon. Nobody's like, I'm going to go to Egypt. It's like, you're going to this town or this town, you're going to Beirut or Cairo, or there's a real sense that you could just take, like, join a caravan on a camel and just go anywhere in the, basically, like, this greater Arab region. And there's not a sense of the nation, right?
Oh, no, the nation does not exist.
The nation, I mean, this is a story about the nation being formed in real time as a container for capitalism and colonial exploitation, right? I mean, this is what we see a culture where there's like no real police, where the political hierarchy is about kind of like there's like emirs, and there's a process of where you can go petition the emir, and that's partially based on tribal affiliation and things like that. And that turns into, you know, a police military. At the end of the book, the first prison is constructed in Haran to house the first political prisoner, right, who's making trouble for the oil company. The state is formed in this case to allow for oil extraction.
Yeah. There's this great moment at the beginning of the book where kind of the first mention of a wider political structure is when these men from, quote, the government come around to take a census, and people are talking, why are they here? These people never come. Like, why do they want a census right now? We should probably introduce
Mitab.
The characters. The main character for the beginning third of the book is a man named Mitab al-Hathal, who is a member of this community. I don't know how the social tribal structure works, but he's a member of the Qum tribe, who have a history of fighting off the Turks. His grandfather is known in the community for having resisted previous invaders, but he's a man who has a family.
And he's kind of a, if not an elder, then certainly a respected
Yes.
Voice in the community.
Yes. And the narrative kind of centers around him. Well, Americans show up to the community and everybody is confused. Who are these people? Where do they come from? Why are they here? Miteb is immediately skeptical. He sees them and just knows in his bones that they represent a kind of change, an apocalyptic change. And there's he as a counterpoint character.
Ibn Rashid?
Ibn Rashid. Ibn Rashid is the man who's kind of hosting the Americans. The dynamic between these two guys is, it's incredible. I don't know. It's like, this is where the cultural register and the mechanism politics all intertwined is in the relationship between Miteb El-Athal and Ibn Rashid.
Yeah, it's very prophetic, and there's a sense of horror. This is something that I really want to get into, but there's a sense of real horror at the idea that these people are going to, like, you know, at the way that the, you know, the quote unquote Americans, we've talked about the Americans label, but it's what the book uses, so we'll go with it. The Americans live, and the idea of pulling oil out of the ground, which, like, you know, appears to these characters as just this demonic thing to do, which it is, right? It is. And it's like, okay, so this is the connection that I really made with this kind of these first moments of reaction, like Miteb Hotel's reactions. It reminded me of Lovecraft. and let me explain. So, you know, Lovecraft's horror stories, because I recently reread The Call of Cthulhu, where he's talking about these ancient beasts that arise from the depths of the earth or the ocean to destroy the world. And the way that he is able to communicate horror is primarily through the reactions and impacts that it has on the human characters in his stories. So because, you know, he'll give some description. He'll be like, Cthulhu has tentacles and looks horrible and blah, blah, blah. But that's not really that scary, right? What's scary is the fact that everyone who sees or touches upon Cthulhu in some kind of way goes insane. And the way that they react and are driven to these depths of just fright and anxiety over it. And of course, it's kind of an ironic connection to make. I mean, because the source of Lovecraft's horror is horror at the non-white and at threats to white European civilization. He was notoriously racist in a specifically colonial way, right? Like a worldwide colonial way.
I mean, he was like a C-rate eugenicist, writing on the tail end of this corrupted American ideology. The Lovecraftian cosmic horror and petrofiction, oil fiction, I've seen that before. It's just that this is an element, an encounter with the unknown, with something that is unknowable to people, does provoke in them a physical, horror level emotional physical reaction. And it's literalized into changes in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple sections. So there's one bit when, you know, so they're wondering just what are these Americans looking for? They don't know. And the words rich and gold hung in the air like smoke. And like a black banner, the big question arose. Had they come to stay? Ibn Rashid's words and actions had turned blind and false. Gold? How on earth could we find gold unless we toiled to find it and ran all over the place? Oil? The naphtha we find is enough to light these lamps of ours that choke you with fumes before they shed light.
Hmm.
So that's a kind of early mention of oil and one of the few.
In the savage heat, thoughts of shade, a cool breeze, dreams held in the daily breath of the mirage. Sweetwater, as in the palm gardens of Katif. The king urged them to search for this precious liquid, hardly believing there could be another more precious.
Yeah, we don't see the moment where the like drill goes into the ground and the oil rushes out. Like we don't see the pipelines, like partially because this is all from the view of mostly of work, like first of the Bedouin who are uprooted and cleared out, and then become workers who are mostly just like maintaining the like lush U.S. residences and like taking things off of boats and stuff like that. They're kept, it seems, far away from that as well.
Yeah. There was another section that kind of literalizes this world rupture in the earth. The background of this scene is Miteb has been outspoken in his fear and hostility towards the Americans. And there's a scene where Miteb is brought along to speak with the emir, and he's brought along because only he was capable of saying everything, of expressing their innermost thoughts. That the things he would say in the social councils was what people were feeling. And yet, when he's brought along to speak with the emir, along with Ibn Rushd, he's completely discounted. Even though he was brought along as the voice of the people, Ibn Rushd becomes the voice of reason, so to speak. You know, the men emphasize to each other that the presentation to the emir should be calm and reasonable, and that Ibn Rushd should do most of the talking since he was an elder and the best speaker. Mm-hmm. Besides, he was on excellent personal terms with the emir and knew most of the Americans. But then Miteb speaks up and the talks go sour because he can't control himself.
It's a great scene also because I loved it because, I mean, it's just, yeah, this kind of personal conference with power. But then also there's this thing where they're both, the emir and Miteb al-Hatal are kind of arguing, but they're doing it politely and they're using the language of like religion and kind of like quoting the Quran at each other, and like in this, in a way that doesn't feel insincere, but it's like, oh yeah, this is like the language that people have, and they're kind of like, if not passive aggressively, then like angrily, like using this language and like turning it back of like religion and God and turning it back on each other in this just amazingly written way. I mean, it's just incredible dialogue.
Yeah, this is that cultural register of politics where the book brings you inside a world where the language of politics is also the language of personal reputation, of kinship, of mutual respect, and kind of assumed obligations. And so, yeah, there's like, Miteb replied sharply, "Listen, Abu Radwan, I'm as old as your father. Don't raise your voice. I can hear you fine. If you want to redden your eye, remember that not everyone is afraid of a red eye. We have come to tell you what our own eyes have seen." These words had a powerful effect not only on the emir, but on his men and on Ibn Hathal himself, who felt so strong that he feared nothing and no one. He's saying, get these Americans out. We want them gone. Or the emir says, we don't want Wadi Al-Un to remain a stable for camels and livestock forever. The friends, he refers to the Americans as friends, want to dig in Wadi Al-Un, and you'll all benefit. And then Ibn Rushd speaks up, by God, Your Excellency, it was the water that was worrying us. Miteb cuts in again. He speaks quickly to cut off this drift towards capitulation. Listen, Ibn Rushd, it's the water and other things, and you know it. So what ends up happening is this hand-waving, the language of friendship, of, hey, I'm the emir, Ibn Rushd is my friend, these guys are my friend, why can't you all accept this? Don't worry about it. It's all in God's hands. We're all good.
Mm-hmm.
And that like register plays out in again and again and kind of subtly transforms in each iteration as the world around them changes. But so this is the personal backdrop to that section that I wanted to read about how the emotional world of this transformation is literalized. And let me try to find it again. This is passage Miteb Al-Hifal was a changed man. Since the heavy rains had come, he spent the whole day in his garden. He had nothing to do there, and his presence or absence made no difference, but it gave him pleasure to watch the water drip into the earth to remain there. Then the earth began to do incredible, unfathomable things. A few days after the rains began, as Miteb himself said, there was a prolonged tremor within the earth, like a convulsion, and the insides of the earth began to spill out. He had seen seedlings planted only a few weeks before pushing up forcibly through the soil, their small tips aloft, getting bigger by the moment. In an attempt to convince Hadib and to convey what he had felt when the earth trembled, Miteb told him that it was like the moment of a man and woman's mating, like a moment of rapture.
It's beautiful. His use of metaphor is just masterful also. But yeah, I mean, it's an amazing sense of a full connection between spiritual life and the earth and kind of the rhythm of everyday life that is completely ruptured. It's, I guess this is what gets back to the cosmic horror thing, as like this sense for me of being like, oh yeah, and then this is what caused our world to currently be burning. You know what I mean? It's like there is a sense that it's like, oh yeah, you like draw things out of the earth, and then and now we are suffering for it, you know, also and will. But I've got one more quote. I do think that Miteb Al-Hifal's reaction is so important. Yeah. And so I've got one more quote from him before we go on about him observing the actions of this camp of oil prospectors. And it's like this vigil. He like, they come in and he just watches them for 3 days. And so it's describing kind of after he comes home after just watching them.
I mean, he's an epic stink eye.
He's amazing. Yeah, Miteb Al-Hifal is an amazing character. And he says, he was utterly changed. After dismounting from his horse, haggard and wild-eyed, extremely feeble or ill, he staggered to his house and fell in front of the door. Nothing his wife could do roused him, so she brought out a mattress and pillows for him to sleep where he lay. She could not convince him to wash his face or to take a cup or two of tea, for he was as spiritless and weak as he was insistent. He seemed to be in a state of crushing depression and frailty, as if the end of the world had come. But he was completely conscious, if despairing, when he finally spoke. And I'll skip a little bit. We should have done something a long time ago, when they first came. I knew they would return. I knew they would do things men and jinn never dreamed of. They came. I saw them myself. In the wink of an eye, they unleashed hundreds of demons and devils. These devils catch fire and roar night and day like a flour mill that turns and turns without tiring out and without anyone turning it. What will happen in this world? How can we kill them before they kill us?
Fuck.
Thousands of rock samples methodically collected, searching for the face of the earth as it was millions of years ago.
This, the tirelessness, the like Protestant work ethic. This is like one source of like the shock of the people there. It's just like these people are just like constantly just running around doing stuff in like the middle of the desert heat or whatever, and then like forcing, and like more than that, like especially eventually like forcing other people to do things for them. And this sense of like there is no rhythm. It's just like build, extract. And there's a real shock at seeing people act like that. The Americans are often described as being like childish or kind of like frenetic also.
Yeah, so how do we move from Wadi Al-Un to Haran? How do we get, which is where the majority of the book takes place?
Well, Miteb Al-Hifal, like his disappearance is also important. I think that's the other like really important part of this book is, or this first part of the book is he recedes in an amazing way. Like he kind of just like everybody gets dispersed, the town gets bulldozed so they could build oil stuff, and he just leaves. And at least when I was reading this, I was expecting it to be like then he comes back with a raiding party and shoots up the American tents or something like that, and it doesn't happen. I don't know if that's a thought that you had or anything.
That's exactly what I expected to happen. Especially since at the very beginning of the book, when they're kind of introducing Miteb, one of his forefathers who has his name is described as leading these raiding parties against the Turks.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to understand kind of patronymic naming conventions of the characters. I had this idea that Miteb Al-Hifal is a man who fights, but they're talking about his grandfather And yeah, he disappears out of kind of despair, which it was like, it was shocking and kind of a gut-wrenching moment, but it was also foreshadowed in a different way by the continued allusions to the way that men or young men will travel for years. They'll leave their families to go off in search of the wonders of the world or a future for themselves. And their mothers will wait often in despair for them to come back. Like, that's part of the psychological landscape. Like, the collective psychology is travel and men going off to find their fortunes and women
waiting for them.
Yeah. So all his family is more than tolerant of Miteb's despondent behavior. It's like, it is their world.
Mm-hmm.
And when he goes, they are despondent, but what can they do?
And also everyone else there's also some expectation with the characters in the book that they think he's going to come back and do something drastic or something.
Yeah. Like his presence is a ghost,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
he never leaves. That people are always referring to him, whether he's not, he's going to come back in the future. 20 years on, people are still wondering if any of the trouble at the labor camp is because of Miteb Ahafel.
It reminds me of what we talked about when we read Memory of Fire, of these yes. kind of mythic guerrilla or bandit figures who are constantly reborn and other people take their names, like Tupac Amaru or these figures in kind of like the Haitian mountains who maybe they're dead, maybe they're alive, maybe they're going to descend and attack the colonial town. Maybe the person who did it is the same person, maybe it's a different person who took their name. And it's a very strong sense of that kind of dynamic, that he almost like becomes a constellation or something. And he does reappear at the end. And it's not clear. I don't know if I want to. This is us not caring about spoilers. But like at the very end, in the final strike, in the worker strike, he is described as joining the crowd of workers and like firing his gun into the air. And, you know, it's so unclear whether that is, I mean, it is that it's just a touch of this kind of mythic sense.
Yeah. So I started reading this book immediately after finishing some of the Dune books by Frank Herbert.
I feel you.
You know, so say what you want about like Orientalism and shitty character writing, but both of these characters, Paul Atreides, Muad'Dib in Dune, and Miteb Ahafel, follow a prophetic narrative. And both of these characters go off into the desert and kind of leave followers wondering.
When I stuck my head out from under the tent, all I could see was sand as far as I see. Nothing but sand. There wasn't anything there.
And, you know, then the stories diverge and whatever. But it was a funny connection for me.
I like how we're just both being real like science fiction bros this episode, and like just bringing in like the worst and shittiest like white science fiction writers to explain our reading of this.
Okay, enough about Dune. Miteb Ahafel leaves and basically never comes back. And then what?
Yeah. There's a quote. When one of his sons returns to the town, this Shalon is his son, and he kind of, they fled and then he came back to seek work as one of the workers in Wadi Al-Uyun in the oil well. And it said, Shalon planted himself in Wadi Al-Uyun, not like the palm trees that had filled the wadi in times gone by, but like one of the iron columns that now stood everywhere. And so it's a transformation. Again, there's a real breakage at that point. And everyone comes, it has to find where to go and is dislocated. And the narrative travel follows mostly the characters who end up working for the oil company.
And it follows them to a coastal town of Haran.
At a small compound on the seacoast at Jubail, headquarters of the American company.
So the oil company is looking to build up a port so that it can import workers and equipment. And this is before they found oil. They just know that they have to build up infrastructure.
My first job in Saudi Arabia was building a pier at Al Khobar, which was the spot where we arrived just a few days before. A pier was necessary in order to bring cargo from the outside.
And the way they attract workers is through Ibn Rushd, Rashid. So he becomes a primary character for much of the book. He cajoles and convinces people to come work for him. He knows that the people of his town who were dispossessed, their sons need work. So he's able to say, you know, come work for me. You know, you can trust me. He uses his reputation and status as a tribal leader, village leader, whatever, to bring tons of laborers to Harran.
For the young Saudi crew, working on well number one was a strange new experience, learning new skills and adapting their ages. But for their American colleagues, the first meager droplets of oil created only hope and anxiety.
He's a really good kind of like villain.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I think this is intentional, but like for most of the book, I hated Ibn Rushd way more than I was hating the Americans. Whether it's intentional or not, it's really clear that this is Munif's focus. Kind of when he's looking at political transformations, he understands how, in this context at least, but you know, we know in many other contexts, the instrument of empire is members of the society who are being colonized. And this is also a moment of class stratification. Before the destruction of the Wadi, we don't know anything about Miteb al-Hathal and Ibn Rushd's respective economic position. It's never spoken of. We assume that they're peers or equals, but Rashid, through his political connections, proletarianizes seemingly the entire village, and he makes himself into a rich man.
Yeah, and a rich man who's just like also just a shitty contractor.
Oh my God, yeah, a motherfucker.
I mean, it's like, yeah, and totally. I don't know if you've ever like worked around construction and shit like that.
Worked for shitty contractors? Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's like very real. It's exactly the same thing where it's like, yeah, the companies that are really making the big money get a contractor who is a guy who's going to be like the asshole who's going to like hire the workers and like make them work faster and like cuss them out and everything like that. And also when they get injured or die, the company is not liable. And this is exactly, I mean, this is like, you know, welcome to work in the 21st century also, right?
Ibn Rushd brings all these workers to Harran, where, and the same thing that happened at Wadi Alun happens in Harran. Seemingly overnight, the village is transformed. And so many things happen. Characters shift in and out.
There's like segregation and apartheid just is like established immediately. There's an American Harran, an Arab Harran, which are the like townspeople and shops.
The pier, another step forward in the search. Regular supplies by Dow. Even prefab housing.
And then like the workers' camp, which are just like shitty corrugated metal, like barracks that the workers like live in cots.
With like lead dripping onto people's heads because like the corrugated, it's corrugated lead.
Yeah, it's a lead roof in like, I looked up on, I mean, it gets to 120 degrees in that area, in the summers, you know? So it's like, yeah, they're describing like literal lead just like melting and dropping onto people's, molten lead dropping onto your face and body at night.
Hellish, hellish conditions.
As a quick note about just place, for anyone who likes to look at things on maps, this town, it seems, is fictionalized Harran, but it's almost certainly Dammam, which is on the Persian Gulf in Saudi Arabia. You can look it up, Dammam.
It's like north of Bahrain.
Yeah, it's close to Bahrain, and it seems to be like now one of the probably the biggest ports in Saudi Arabia.
So if we didn't say it explicitly before, I think that these scenes where the workers are experiencing fear and malaise as they realize that their living conditions are just deteriorating is a good time to really highlight how unique and different the narrative structure. Like we said, it doesn't have one central character, but the way we've been talking, we're talking about these people as if we're in their heads. It feels like the narrator is this omniscient kind of drifting spirit that can touch down and observe both conversations that are happening and people's state of mind or responses. But within a single paragraph, within a chapter, it will drift between different sites of conversation, different people. And oftentimes the narrator will just ask questions that were being asked by like the collective. So at the beginning, the collective is the Wadi Alun. So it'll say things like no one could describe what was going on. These were moments of serious scrutiny, fear, and surprise.
In some ways similar to when we read The Unseen and everything was we.
Yeah. Yeah. And other times later on, there's kind of in the work camps, there are these conflicts between Ibn Rashid's henchman, a translator, and his labor boss. And people are wondering, like, what did Dammam say? Why was Naeem calm after yesterday's threats? But these are like rumors and whispers and gossips. Like maybe the people who are asking them were there at the time when something happened. But it feels more like the narrator is just reporting the ambient concerns of everybody who's in the social space.
There's another related thing that happens where it's a character will speak and will be identified, but they've never been introduced and we don't see them again. It's just like, so-and-so said this, and the name is given. And so you get that sense of being in the collectivity that there is this person, but we don't know quite who they are, and we don't need a description of them or to take that further. It even does that. The only time that we see any of the Americans speak, it's like Sinclair. The names are really funny. It's like Sinclair was like, these Arabs are so, like, whatever, like, just, you know, says something like patronizing.
Our Saudi guides continued to lead the way across the desert. Their cosmic sense of scale and distance, our constant help through the unmapped land.
And then that's the only time. And then it's like that the Americans are totally interchangeable. And, you know, so that's another way that that's accomplished.
Yeah. And I mean, there's like this idea that identity is about being part of a collective, being embedded in a community. It's like written into this book in so many ways. And there's two quotes that I think express this. One is actually kind of explicit. Storytelling is a form of collective remembrance.
I think we highlighted all the same quotes in this.
Amazing. In the early evening, their conversation was comical and ambiguous. But as night came on with the moonrise and the twinkling of the stars, it turned to other places and times past. Every man has a past, and those who so poetically depicted these distant places and lost times were rare indeed. But they were the backbone of the camp and its most important residents. The workers gathered around them, and they initiated the nightly council. With every new song or biting comment or remembrance that stirred their hearts and minds, most of them felt more strongly than ever that they were nowhere, wearing themselves out for nothing, and they were filled with sadness and regret. They felt alone. Forgotten. Another amazing quotation. This is from the perspective of Meteb Al-Hafal's son. At no place and at no time in his life had Fawaz ever been gripped by fear as he was now in this place. How did these men sleep and where? How did they eat? Why were they so different from the sort of people who used to live in Wadi Al-Un, who lived in Ujra and Al-Mashti and Al-Hadra? It seemed to him that each of these men lived by himself without any connection to the others around him.
Yes. Can I make a connection here?
Yeah.
Because I really gravitated towards those sections as well. And it made me think, I mentioned this before too, this book, Joyful Militancy. And a part of it, the quote about freedom. And so I'm going to read some of this. I think it's a really useful key to thinking about this stuff. So this quote is about the etymology of freedom. And so it says, look for the dictionary definition of freedom today, and you'll find rights, absences, and lacks of restriction at the core applied to an isolated individual. At bottom, all of these definitions are about getting away from an external restriction or influence, being unhindered, unaffected, independent. Under capitalism, freedom is especially associated with free markets and the free agent who chooses based on individual preferences. Freedom and friend share the same early Indo-European root, free or pre, meaning love. 1,000 years ago, the Germanic word for friend was the present participle of the verb freon, to love. This language also had an adjective, frisia. It meant free, as in not in slavery, where the reason to avoid slavery was to be among loved ones. Frisia meant beloved, belonging to the circle of one's beloved friends and family. And this is, they go on to quote the invisible community and our friends. I think it's a good quote, so I'll just continue. Friend and free in English come from the same Indo-European root, which conveys the idea of a shared power that grows. Being free and having ties was one and the same thing. I am free because I have ties, because I am linked to a reality greater than me. A few centuries later, freedom became untied from connectedness. The 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes imagined freedom as nothing more than an absence of opposition possessed by isolated, selfish individuals. When peasants were free during this period, it has often meant that they had been forced from their lands and their means of subsistence, leaving them free to sell their labor for a wage in the factories or starve. It is no coincidence that these lonely conceptions of freedom arose at the same time as the European witch trials, the enclosure of common lands, the rise of the transatlantic slave trade, and the colonization and genocide of the Americas. I don't know. I mean, for me, it's like you really, this book so demonstrated that taking the land from people, ripping them from family, and then entering into individual labor, wage labor contracts with them as individuals is how this is allowed. And that I think these characters maintain that sense that freedom for them is being is interconnectedness. That's the other part of it.
So there's a scene where all the certain like men are brought in to speak with the company. And like there are all these rumors like, oh, they want you to come in and talk. They're just going to ask you a few questions. Mm-hmm. And people are like, what are you asking about? Like, why do you want us? And there's kind of this fear, like, why are we being called in as individuals? The idea that the company would want to speak with Fawaz Al-Hathal.
Who's just a guy who's just a worker at this point.
Right. Why would they want to speak to me? Like fear. And so they bring people in and ask these questions. Your name, full name, fathers and grandfathers, Ibrahim Al-Falah Al-Ibrahim, the name before your grandfathers, Ibrahim Al-Falah Al-Ibrahim Al-Muhammad, etc. Mother's name, Ibrahim Al-Falah gives Naim, the translator, an astonished, shocked look, then looked at the three Americans, and when he saw them awaiting his reply, he said, "What do you want with my mother?" Naim shot him a serious, almost rebuking glance, then turned to the Americans and translated what Ibrahim had said. The three Americans roared with laughter, and one of them, who knew Arabic, spoke, "The information we need is quite simple and necessary." He paused for a moment and smiled, then stood up, went over to Ibrahim until he was opposite him and patted it on the shoulder. And these questions go on, and then they start asking about his sisters. Like, how many brothers do you have? Are you the oldest, the youngest? How many sisters? God help me, leave me alone. We told you, said Naeem firmly. This information will remain confidential and no one will see it. It is important for the company to know. And we don't know why the company wants to know this yet. Ibrahim does not know. Reading this, it was like a violation. You just tell it. I don't understand or know the kind of taboos on like familial gender stuff. So like, yo, ask me how many sisters I have. I don't care. That's not invasive. But it's clear this was in a deep violation to these people. And then like on the next chapter, the men are talking about the questions that they were being asked. The bastards want to know everything, said Ibrahim al-Nasir. Even why my father got divorced and remarried. They wanted to know if I was unclean, because I didn't pray all the time. They asked if I had a lot of wet dreams, and they laughed. The bastards want to know who has planted every seed and laid every egg in history. He spat angrily.
Yeah, it's an extractivist approach to knowledge, as well as an extractivist approach to the earth. It's interesting, this touches on that kind of like sexual aspect or encounter that's a big undercurrent in the book, not overtly, but not as sex, but like, and even just discursively. And I wanted to ask you about this part because there's a couple of these really important scenes that involve this, what appears to be a cruise ship arriving to the port.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, what was your reaction to this? Because, you know, it's just describing a cruise ship and the kind of like the shock and interest of the men of the town and the workers as they see this like cruise ship come that's like full of like women in swimsuits who are described. It's interesting because they're described as being naked, and which I read as, you know, almost naked. I mean, sometimes they're described as being almost naked. And, you know, and just like horror at like what almost like looks like an orgy or something. But then obviously also there's like humor to it, right? Everyone wants to like also see what's going on. I don't know how you reacted to that or if you felt that was kind of like important to the wider sense of the novel.
Yeah, it was really important plot wise. It was referred to often as like this another rupture in the world of what's acceptable and like a grievance, right? Like these Americans are godless. I took it really seriously, and it would be easy to read this and think, oh, how like primitive or simple or ignorant or whatever.
How misogynist.
Right.
Yeah.
And I could see that being a reaction, but I just took it seriously. Like the language and the writing made it clear, like it wasn't about the sex, it wasn't about the gender, it was about an encounter with like a change that overwhelms a sense of rightness with the world for the people who saw it. And this is where that collective narrative played a powerful role, because like he could describe what the collective was doing and what the impact on the collective psyche was, even though there's a whole range of responses in the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like the younger boys are just gawking, and some of the boys are playing pranks on the Americans, and some of the men are just gawking, and some of the older men are like appalled. One of the men falls in love, kind of becomes obsessed with this one woman that he sees, and starts squirreling away the pictures of like women in magazines, like the Western magazines that are coming into town. And like, but the collective psyche is, none of the men could sleep that night. They all had like wet dreams, and they were tormented and discomforted. Like,
yeah.
And it was just like, I don't know why, like maybe it's because they're like the sexual script of their life is disrupted. Like they don't know how they're going to go home and marry.
Yeah.
Like they're denied access to sexual maturity in a way that is culturally appropriate them.
Mm-hmm.
And this book brought me into it.
Yeah, totally.
Like without knowing anything about this shit. And I felt inside of it.
And there's a sense of loss of control there too, right? It's like, yeah. It's not just that the men, and it's men who are described watching this, the women like, you know, leave that area. In fact, that's part of it. But It's like, also, yeah, you don't have any autonomy over whether these like ships full of like almost naked people are coming into your town and like what they do. It's like there's a sense there that it is, on top of all that, entirely imposed, that the people and the collectivity in the novel is forced to view this without being able to react or have say or like have any say in like who comes in or how they come in or how they're acting in the town that was there so recently. And that is, in this case, and it's in many ways, but in this case, it's expressed through kind of like that sexual anxiety.
In a later scene with these women, the emir of Harran becomes obsessed. He gets a telescope or binoculars or something, and he just wants to spend all day catching glances of these American women, and like sneeringly describes his fantasies.
The emir is kind of this comic figure in the book.
Oh my god, he's so stupid.
Yeah, he's just like an idiot. Like, it's obvious, like there's definitely a sense throughout this whole thing that the people in power are just the people who happen to be fucking there. And most of the time they're idiots.
Yeah, they're asleep at the fucking wheel.
Yeah, and there's this kind of like, there's a sense, I don't know if you read 100 Years of Solitude, but like the traders who come through the town every few years in this like isolated village on the Pacific and like bring new inventions. And then the main character becomes like obsessed with a new invention every time that this trader comes. And it's exactly this process in the second type of the book. And it's like, first it's the telescope and then it's a radio. And there's all this excitement about the radio. I mean, there's no electricity. And it's, but I loved it because like there's a sense of that. But it also really subverts this narrative of like, oh yeah, there's these like people who are living without technology. And then the technology itself is encountered, or like some cultural artifact. You know, it's like Disney or Coca-Cola, and then that like corrupts the traditional life. And it's also not that, like, and there's this great moment where it's like the emir is obsessed with the radio and like wants to figure out how it works and like wants to show everyone. And then like everyone's kind of like gossiping and talking about the radio. And then like, of course, it's like a trader culture. And then there are these guys who are like, yeah, it's like a radio. Everyone in Baghdad has one. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So there's a sense that it's like, it's not, I don't know. I feel like that's a like really dumb, like, you know, narrative that I grew up with or something, where it's like, I don't know. I remember watching this stupid movie when I was a kid where it's like, you know, these like people in Africa like find a Coke bottle or something, and then it's like all the ways that the like Coke bottle like changes the village or something. And it's like this obsession with the idea that like those changes are brought on by like individual objects or Disney or something like that, which of course, like, yeah, there's like, you know, that's part of it, but like the engine of change here is not that there's like a radio, that the emir has a radio. The engine of change is that like everyone's houses got bulldozed and they have nowhere to go without working for the company or whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, the changes are technological. There's, yep, there's the construction of the road from Ujra to Harran, and that coincides with the completion of a pipeline, you know, which implies that they discovered oil and are now shipping it. After the highway is completed, cars are introduced, and two more characters come to town, and one's from Lebanon, you know, as a Christian, I think, or something. Just more men, and they're not foreigners. They're just, they're not like white European foreigners. They're like Middle Eastern foreigners, whatever. They're not foreigners. They speak Arabic.
There's one of the guys is an Armenian.
That's right.
And it's implied. It's interesting because it's really like, well, even the way that it's never like, oh, he doesn't speak Arabic that well. But there are these like moments. I mean, Munif is such a good writer. And there are these moments of like confusion in language with the Armenian guy, where it just gets, you feel what it feels like where it's like, okay, this is probably his second language, but it never says it, and it never does like a weird like dialect thing. It just describes these misunderstandings between like him and his friend or something.
And so this is where like it's not a simple story of colonization or imperialism or capitalism or modernity. None of these are simple, and the encounters are multi-layered. So like the Armenian truck driver
who I'm sorry, this is really interesting. He's such an interesting character, who was a survivor of the Ottoman massacres of the Armenians. Sorry, go on.
There's another character who comes in later in the book who's a doctor from Damascus, Beirut, Cairo, doesn't matter, but he's a professional. Mm-hmm. And he comes to town, and there's no other professional doctor, but there is a traditional doctor healer. And this guy's kind of described as like a community scoundrel, like kind of weirdo. He never pays for anything. He never pays for anything, but he does so much for everybody that they'll give him anything he asks. And he's poor. He goes into the desert and hunts for rats. But he's a really important figure because he is one of like two traditional doctors.
It's actually an amazing description of a gift economy, where it's like he doesn't charge money because, let me just read some of it. After Haran underwent the changes and the floods of people moved in, men would sometimes pull money out of their pockets and tell Mufadi, who's the healer, "If you can tell me how much this is worth, it's yours." Mufadi would turn the bill or coin over and examine the lines and marks upon it, then return it, saying, "Do you want the truth? By God, I don't know." The men would laugh a little and then try again with another piece of money, but with the same results. Mufadi never worked for money and did not hide his contempt for it, nor did he trade his services for favors. He got extremely angry when anyone offered to pay him, no matter how much or how little. And then it goes on to describe how, yeah, like people just like, he didn't take money. He would just do his services for people. But when his shoes wore out or he needed something, he would kind of show up and either ask for it or people would make sure that he got it. And it's not a one-for-one exchange. It's not a barter economy that's being described. It's a gift economy where people would give him things when he needed those things. And when people needed healing, he would heal people.
Munif will take time to describe certain rhythms and certain exchanges, and he will breeze over others. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something to pay attention to. When he talks about material exchanges, he's trying to tell us something about the characters or their community or their relationships. And other times, he assumes that we, the readers, don't need to know, or that we take certain things for granted. I don't know. So I agree that was a really important characterization.
I'm sorry, and I think I interrupted you, but you were kind of going on to talk about maybe that crescendo.
Yeah. I was hoping that maybe you could give, like, a summary, because I kind of lost the plot of it. Yeah. Towards the end, but I have the outline. So again, Mufadi, there's this another rivalry, so kind of mirroring the rivalry between Miteb al-Hathal and Ibn Rashid, between Mufadi and Dr. Subi. And Dr. Subi marches into town and is like, wants to establish himself as a professional doctor, buddies up to the emir, really leans on his training and his like Kantian austerity, you know, personal hygienics and whatever. He's like such a weird dude, but it seems really important for him to discredit Mufadi so that he can start charging people for his services. He's that image of a rich doctor that, you know, knows how to heal people because he's trained in medicine and can heal people from ailments that they probably couldn't get healed from otherwise. But he's also kind of maybe a quack. Like, he's always like injecting things as like a simple remedy, and we don't know anything about that.
Yeah, he's kind of like a grifter character a little bit. It's implied that maybe there was like malpractice stuff where he came from. Like, it's not clear like why he left the city to go there. Yeah, he's like
shady.
Yeah, he's like a shady character for sure.
But it's uncertain, to at least to me, like whether he was a good or bad doctor. His reputation precedes him and kind of clouds everybody, you know, the characters and therefore the reader's understanding of him. But so this rivalry, he for whatever reason, really can't stand Mufadi and starts driving up kind of a mistrust of him and gets the emir to put him in jail. And then there is this, like, the emir's enforcer ends up murdering Mufadi.
Or having him murdered.
Having him murdered for reasons that...
Johar,
yeah.
And we see in the novel when, again, the prison is built and then also Johar and his men get their uniforms and, like, the police are formed during this time in this area.
Yeah. Max, can you, like, talk more about that? Because I'm kind of shaky on the details.
Yeah. It feels like a really true sense of how... of like indignities and insults, and then also more constant bad material conditions. It's like, it really shows like what leads to rebellion, right? Because it's showing, yeah, Mufadi is insulted and driven out and then murdered, and they refuse to investigate because obviously the people who murdered him were in fact the authorities. And these like two beloved truck drivers are like driven out of business by these like other truck companies that have a lot of funding. And at the same time, like everyone is still living in their like these like shitty barracks, and they've been promised housing for like years and they're not getting it. And it's all of that kind of at the same time. And there's this like real sense of like a build of indignities. And then it's when, you know, 25 workers or something are laid off, it turns into a strike. So there's a sense, and there's even people in the novel who are like, well, why didn't they do this before when like more people were fired or blah, blah, blah. And it's really showing, I think, the way that these led that moments of rebellion, that moments of resistance, there's a lot that goes into it. And there's like a kind of a chemistry that can't always be recreated or reproduced on either end. And it has a lot as much to do with like how people are feeling about how they're treated emotionally as like just the working conditions. But then the last part of the book, the very last part of the book, this book comes to a crescendo and it ends. I mean, it's amazing. And it's, you feel the strangeness and the newness of the strike. The strike is not a form that people are like, oh, let's do a strike. Like, people are like inventing the strike, you know? They decide together to not go to work. They like smash up the gates of the American compound. And we kind of are shifting from people giving speeches at the mosque and in the market squares to the emir and the security forces who are like, what do we do about this? And basically just, you know, listening to the Americans. There's a sense that we see how this happens. And there's also a sense that there's something mysterious to it that nobody could predict.
Nobody can predict it. And there are these great conversations between the emir and the companies. The company keeps on asking the emir, so why are they striking? Mm-hmm. Like, again, you said, why not now? It can't just be about the firing. Why have we never seen strikes like this before? Why didn't they strike 2 months ago or after the pipeline was completed when we laid off a lot more workers? You clink one goblet on another and 1,000 dancers come running, suggested Johar. They needed an excuse and they found one. The phenomenon facing us today must be examined and treated on two levels, said Philip, reading from a sheet of paper. The first is the immediate one, the strike. It must end without the company giving in and without acts of violence. The second concerns the workers' conditions, which must be studied carefully to reveal their deep-seated causes. Are there political implications? Are there organizers or instigators at work? Are there factors outside the company and the workplace? And Johar and the Emir's council are kind of like, we know it's something, but like, they're just Bedouins. You can't control them. We never know what these fuckers are gonna do.
Yeah.
And that's mirrored by this like emergence of an organic class consciousness that is not seen before in the book. This quote at the strike, Ibn Nefes said that there was strength in unity and that a loyal fraternal group should never be defeated. Whereas if they differed among themselves, if their aims and desires were in conflict, they were finished. Ibn Nefes said all this and a great deal more besides. He chose his texts from the Quran carefully and recited them in clear and melodious tones, so they took deep root in the hearts of the congregation and affected them deeply. His listeners felt like a new breed of men, made of some new substance. And this is preceded by two or three whole pages listing in clear materialist terms what the Americans have done to them, which the book, yeah, we haven't seen in the book. True, the company was paying them now, but the next day workers paid out again what they had received. Prices went up every day and their savings declined. The promises Ibn Rushd had made years before, as he heard of them from Ujra and elsewhere about the houses they would find in Haran and the life they would enjoy, had predeceased even Ibn Rushd. Why did the Americans make them perform tasks that they themselves would never dream of doing? Although the workers held their peace and showed them nothing but contentment, the Americans were never satisfied by anything but constant work. And the emir? Was he their emir, there to defend and protect them? Or was he the American's emir? He had been a different man when he first came to Haran. He used to stroll through the market and invite town folks to his house to drink coffee, but he changed abruptly when Hassan Razay and others started bringing him gifts. He was enthralled by those gadgets and left all of his responsibilities to Jahar. Like, yeah, this just erupts out of the characters.
Yeah, yeah. And from a little reading I found, this does mirror strikes that happened in this port city in the early 50s.
But oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a basis there. But no, and it's amazing. And I think that what you're saying also about these material terms is that, like, this is what this book does, is it takes us from, even though the book was written in Arabic, and I have questions. I'm interested in like what style of Arabic, but the book was written in Arabic and moves to English, but the language and the terms and the ways that describe the things are described at the end of the book feel like part of our world and a language we have access to. And the earlier part of the book feels like a different conception of space and time and relation to others. But then it's interesting, then the strike is almost a synthesis of that. The strike is experiencing that split, becoming the proletariat, becoming the individual worker, and then being able to find solidarity in those conditions.
Boom. I think I want to say one last thing, which is I wanted to highlight the focus of Munir's harshest criticism, which seems to be on the behavior of the elites, of men like the emir, of Ibn Rushd, of the doctor, and of several of these other characters who consistently act to consolidate their own political power at the expense of their people. I was about to say the working people, but that's like not the political economy that it's founded on. Like, that's what it becomes. In Thoreau, the translator's review of this book, he highlights that Munif's critique, his broader political project, was critiquing the bad political choices of Saudi elites, of Middle Eastern elites, to squander the oil wealth, the opportunities that they had to modernize in a way that benefited like everybody, that whatever corruption or just shitty leadership is like, that's where they're not like the cause of anything, but he's angry.
Yeah, you can tell he hates the Saudi royal family. I mean, I'm really interested in reading these other volumes that are more directly about them, because you can feel that coming through here, even where they're more distant. Well, I think on that note, again, feel like there's so much more to say, but it's in the book. I just can't emphasize, it's an amazing book on the prose level, as just in terms of certainly what it got me thinking about. And I really appreciate having this chance to read it.
Thus, the kingdom had entered the stage of world oil.
Thanks for listening to the Unseen Book Club. Intro music, as always, by Xofficial. Find their music at xofficialexo.bandcamp.com. The questionable sound clips you heard throughout this episode were pulled from the 1984 Aramco-produced documentary Era of Discovery, which you can find, hopefully to your great amusement, on YouTube. Find us on Twitter at Unseen Book Club or send us an email at unseenbookclub@gmail.com. We're reading a bunch of really exciting books in the coming months, from Victor Hugo's Les Miserables to Patricia Galvao's Industrial Park, and a new translation of Mexican novelist Rafael Bernal's His Name Was Death. Until next time, take care.